Ken Derwin here today. Kent is one of the most amazing experimentalists I know of. He's best known for his work in bolometric photon detectors. These are things that are used in CMB experiments. They are used in dark matter searches now, even in nuclear non-proliferation programs. and for example, he also has the gold medal from the US Department of Commerce. So, and he will tell us today about some new ideas for how to look for dark matter when there are axions or hidden photons. So,
thank you, Nina. So thanks very much for the invitation. It's nice to be back in this cold and snow. I am originally from Colorado, so it's felt like that this week. So thank you very much. See if I can find that hockey stick. Okay, so I'm actually going to be talking about kind of a broader range of things, not just this experiment, talking about optimization, but I wanted to give credit up front to the team that collaborates with on one particular dark matter search experiment, although I'm trying to be speaking much more broadly, which is most of the people are at Stanford and from Slack. We have collaborators at Berkeley and some extensions to it also with Lyman Page and Tony Tyson at Davis and Princeton. And I will point out that a lot of the broad optimization statements that I'm going to be making are going to be published later in this month in a paper by Saptarshi Chowdhury, who's the senior grad student on this project. So what I'm going to try to do is actually start, first of all, by something that everyone in this room probably knows more about than I do, but just to get us on the same table, I'll make short shrift of it, is dark matter in the field-like limit, specifically axions and hidden photons. But then what I really want to do is talk about how you can do an optimal experiment to couple to vectors and pseudoscalars, to couple to axions and hidden photons. Typically, what the field has done so far in things like ADMX is do something pretty good, but I think we've been lacking an analysis of how you can couple to the maximum power, get the maximum signal to noise, understand all the quantum limits and how to outperform them. So I'll talk about this from the perspective of impedance matching to the dark matter, talk about quantum noise and integrated scan sensitivity, and show that there are actually some fundamental limits on how well you can impedance match that's set by something called the Bodifano criterion. And then talk about the derived quantum limited science reach. And then spend the next part of the talk talking about how you can do better than that, where the quantum limited means if you're measuring like both quadratures of an electromagnetic field, you're going to always have a photon of noise. If you start doing some quantum sensing tricks, things like squeezing, entanglement, back action evasion, how much better you can do. And then talk, describe especially that even if you're in a thermal state in this sort of experiment, there's advantages to quantum sensors and why that is. And then at the end, I'll come to the specific experiment that we're working on now called the Dark Matter Radio that is searching for axions and hidden photons in the frequency range of about 100 hertz to 100 megahertz. Okay, so let's start with the very, very brief overall description of these candidates. And of course, we're talking about a very low mass range. Where to get the observed abundance of dark matter, you have to have a high occupation number so that these are field-like rather than particle-like. Instead of thinking about WIMPs scattering off of a crystal and measuring individual events, it's a high occupation number, it's a field that you're coupling to. And so you start about talk about doing amplifiers and things like that. So it's a coherent wave. The wavelength is set by the de Broglie wavelength, which is typically larger than the experiments in the frequency ranges at the low end. And then you start getting up into the cavity limit at higher frequency, you get out of that. But I'll be talking about specifically about the coherent limit. And we're looking for that classical field. Also, we're in a regime where quantum noise is, you think of it not in terms of measuring the energy resolution of one event, but of measuring how much extra noise you have from vacuum noise and amplifiers. So, of course, there's been a lot of, I think, growing interest in the theoretical community looking at non-WIMP dark matter candidates. ADMX has been searching for axions for a long time, but there's a number of different experiments that are trying to expand to look for both pseudoscalars and vectors. Pseudoscalars are the famous ones, axions, that they can also, if they have the right properties, be dark matter and solve the strong CP problem in QCD, explain the neutron electric dipole moment, why it's so small, so much smaller than one would guess, things like that. So it's called the Pecci-Quinn solution. And there's a theoretical bias I know that people have, which I actually don't necessarily agree with, that the universe obeys Occam's razor. That you want to have one particle that is both the dark matter and still solves strong QCD, or is supersymmetry and isn't dark matter. And it's true, certainly in science, there's lots of famous examples where one thing solved multiple things. But as an experimentalist, I know if you got one problem, typically there's three things you have to fix. And the universe was not miserly with the standard model. So my personal bias is I believe that the QCD axion exists, and probably something else is dark matter, and there's a whole zoology of things, because the universe is complicated. That's my bias. But it's very exciting to look for these both as a possible solution to the strong CP problem, and also as a dark matter candidate. And if it doesn't have the exact parameters you want to be strong be the QCD axion, then you'd call it an axion-like particle, still very interesting. And this is a plot from Leslie Rosenberg from the constraints that have been placed both by cosmology and by the ADMX microwave cavity work. I believe that there's some new things that have been added to that since. And there's also Haystack, which is searching for at a slightly higher frequency. Okay, so one thing to know, of course, about axions is that you do need to have something else to couple to them. You need a big magnetic field if you're going to use the Primakov effect. But then with a magnetic field and with an axion, you can induce a photon. And in general, everything I'm going to be talking about today, you're looking for an electromagnetic signal, an electromagnetic coupling in the Lagrangian to either axions or hidden photons. And that's what we're trying to do, is derive the fundamental limits for scans for that particular coupling, not for things like nuclear spin. Okay, hidden photon is kind of generically a vector boson that has mass that couples to ordinary electromagnetism without the big magnetic field, but just through kinetic mixing. But once again, it's something where you exclude normal electromagnetism and you look for signals that should not be there. And there's ways to generate it in the observed dark matter abundance by things like inflationary fluctuations, a very nice paper that Peter Graham's group put out on that that's getting fairly well known at this point. So they're also a very attractive candidate. And I don't know, just like in WIMPs, there's the two things that motivate WIMPs are the Occam's razor, who said there's a naturalness argument as well, is that there's a nice way in the 10 to 100 GeV range, the WIMP miracle to create in the right abundance. In a sense, these inflationary generation mechanisms are sort of a vector miracle. I don't know if like you'd agree with that, Mina. But if you knew R, there would be a nice mass range that would be well motivated, where you would naturally create the cosmological abundance. So first get the CMB telescopes working, nail R, and then you've got a vector miracle, right? Okay. But both of these, it turns out that we can measure, we look for both of these with similar apparatus. And that's what we're doing in the case of DM radio. And in both of them, there's a lot of unexplored parameter space. And you know, the community has put so much of its resources into WIMP detectors that it's all the low-hanging fruit is gone. It's now casts of hundreds, putting like, you know, $100 million into like pushing down the limit a little bit more. The great thing about opening up your phase space experimentally is there's low-hanging fruit. There's experiments you can do in the lab to set interesting limits with a few grad students. So like with axions, all sorts of exciting parameter space. This is reflecting my bias that I'm thinking about this field-like range. And same thing with vectors, with hidden photons. Lots of unexplored parameter space that you can fill in a few years in your own lab. You don't even have to go to a mine, which is nice. Okay, so that's stuff that you guys all knew. So how can you do this optimally? And you know what? You know, the most famous experiment searching for axions so far is ADMX, which is basically a microwave cavity that's where you exclude ordinary electromagnetism. Axions come in, you've got a big magnetic field, and you ring up the cavity. And this is usually described in time space. As you think of a resonator, it's got a little signal coming in and it rings up over time. And if it's high Q, you get a bigger signal. The math is certainly done right. But if you actually wanted to think about what is the fundamental limit on how well you could couple to the signal, thinking of it as a fully rung up cavity in a Fourier space is actually much more informative, because there actually are fundamental limits. And you ask yourself, why a resonator? Well, the first question is why, if you just have something that's creating some effective electrical field, could you just make a metal film and couple power to it? And then just make it a really, really low impedance film. Why don't you do that is one question. And another question is well, why a cavity? Why a single pole? Could you do better by having a multi-pole structure, some sort of a Chebyshev filter? And we can answer both of those questions. And then what is the thing you're trying to optimize? What are you trying to optimize in terms of signal and noise over a large mass space? We need to have some sort of a figure of merit for integrated scan sensitivity to do this optimization. And this is where kind of the Bode-Fano limit's going to come in, that says how well you can do, whether it's a single pole resonator or something else. And then we'll derive from that the quantum limited science reach, and we'll describe what that means. So let's start with how do you couple dark matter power to the electrons? And I'm talking about electromagnetic coupling to electrons. There's lots of other couplings. So let's talk about a really simple kind of Ganaken experiment, a simple example. Let's assume we've just got a dark matter plane wave. Can be axions, can be hidden photons, doesn't matter. And you're doing whatever you need to do so that it's creating some sort of an effective electrical field. Now let's first ask this question, well, why don't you just couple it into a bolometer, just like you do with the astronomical instruments? If you want to look at starlight and you're in the microwave range, you want to do better than a semiconductor, you build a bolometer. So why don't we do that with dark matter? And so let's just assume that we've got this plane wave. It's creating, through some magic of either Primakoff or kinetic mixing, creating an effective electric field of the dark matter. And then you say, okay, we're going to assume it's a stiff field. We can set limits on that. But in fact, experimentally, it's always going to have a source impedance of zero. It's going to be a very stiff field. And you say, well, is that all we need to know? Because if you have a perfectly stiff electrical field, well, V squared over R is the power in a resistor. Why don't you make R just really, really small and couple infinite power? That's kind of the first question if you're thinking this through in a Fourier space sense. So how do you impedance match to a dark matter source field? And it's not that simple. It turns out to be tricky. So let's carry out this one simple idea. Is suppose you just have a plane wave of dark matter. It's coherent in free space, and you hit a two-dimensional sheet so that you can think of it as a one-dimensional problem. And you give it some sort of, I'm going to make this a sheet conductance, some sigma that's less than infinity. What would you want that conductance to be to get the most power from that electric field? And is it as simple as E dark matter squared times sigma, like over 2, if you're dealing with the fact that it's a peak-to-peak or an RMS? And the answer is not that simple. And the reason is if you have this effective dark matter field that's accelerating those electrons, the electrons are then going to emit ordinary light, photons in both directions, plane waves. And that coupling makes it so that you couple very, very poorly to the dark matter. Now, why? Is that you actually just have to, you can just write the modified Maxwell's equations with this effective field term, and you just solve the very, very simple like wave equations with the boundary condition at that surface, and you calculate how much current is driven and the optical photon signal that you generate by moving those electrons in both directions. And what you find is that I squared R, the power coupled to that film becomes, well, this term you make sense. It's like a V squared over R, like a resistor. You get an EDM squared over Z, but this is now the impedance of free space, 377 ohms, because that's the impedance for the emitting the photons. And you get this equation, basically. You've got the impedance of free space to ordinary photons. You have ZR, which is the sheet impedance, 1 over the sigma R. And you have an optimization that, in fact, it's got a maximum. The maximum power you can couple to the electrons is limited by the fact that the electrons are very strongly bound to photons. And it's like some molasses. It's like a drag. Those electrons, they're much more strongly coupled to light, and they don't want to move. As long as those electrons are coupled to light, you can't dump much power into them from dark matter. And if you optimize that, which is with a simple calculation, you show that the maximum power is less than about 1/4 of E dark matter squared over 377 ohms free space. You can't beat that. And it turns out that that's for a sheet impedance of half of the free space impedance, which is exactly what you do for an astronomical instrument if you're trying to couple the photons. But a broadband resistive absorber is a terrible impedance match to dark matter because you've got this photon coupling that's like a molasses that slows them down. Make sense? A little bit? Okay. The photons are the problem. You want to get rid of the photons. So how do you get rid of you decouple them. How do you get rid of the photons is you decouple them. We know how to do that. For instance, you can just put a back short that's like a half wave away, and you make it a terrible antenna. You want to make this an awful antenna. And so if you do the same wave equation solution for this, where you have a plane wave coming in, although the interesting thing is with the dark matter, its wavelength is the de Broglie wavelength, and so it's going to be completely coherent. So the electrons that are accelerating in your resistive sheet are going to have the same phase on them as in your back short, which we're making a perfectly conducting sheet. And then you can just tune the distance between the sheets so that the optical plane wave coming from the back short is canceling the optical plane wave that would be emitted by the resistive sheet. You're now decoupling the photons, and you can cleanly couple to just the dark matter. This, by the way, is like a tuned cavity. You've got like a back short, it's got some length. It's no longer a simple resistive sheet, but you put in the numbers, and if you assume that it's perfectly at a half a wavelength, it simples down to the power you're coupling is just, except for that two, is just what you expect. It's V squared times your conductance. The factor of two is because you've got a coherent cancellation, a destructive interference in the optical photons, but you've got a constructive interference in terms of the power that goes into the electrons. So it gives you slightly more. Well, that's great. Now we can impedance match. And if we said that their source impedance from the dark matter is very, very low, it's a very, very stiff voltage, then at first blush, it looks like we can impedance match like whatever we want. The higher you make your conductance of the film, the more power you couple. And then you start not asking, can you find the dark matter, but can you power your house out of the dark matter? Okay, so radiated visible waves from the back short destructively interferes with the visible wave. They decouple it. This is great. But no, we cannot go to infinite coupling by going to infinity. There's a couple of problems. One is virialization. The dark matter is not perfectly still. It's not going to all be at exactly the same frequency. If you have a dark matter at some mass, you typically convert it to a frequency HF equals MC squared, plus a little bit of kinetic energy, which is like a part per million for the dark matter virialized in the galaxy. So that's a limit on how much power you can couple. And the other limit is that actually the source impedance of dark matter is not zero. It's limited by the amount of dark matter that there is. And you can back act on the dark matter in principle. So if you had a Gedanken experiment, if everything was perfect and there was no virialization, and you just kept increasing your sigma until you reached that you were sucking all the power out of the dark matter, essentially you'd then be back acting, emitting a dark matter wave that would cancel the dark matter, just like in ordinary electronics. But you'll never get anywhere close to that.
I could, in principle, absorb all the flux of the dark matter that comes through the sheet. This is what you're saying.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. And in the language of impedance matching, you're saying, or in the electronics language, you're back acting on the dark matter field. You're emitting a dark matter field that cancels the other dark matter, which is the same thing as just sucking the energy out of the dark matter. But if we were, but you know, so like I said, dark matter has a Q of like 10 to the 6. I mean, the virialization is like a part in 10 to the 6. To get to the sort of like quality factors of this setup where you are absorbing all the dark matter, I forget the number, we've got it in the paper. It's something like a Q of 10 to the power of 24 or something like that. It's crazy out of reach. So you can assume that the dark matter is perfectly stiff, but virialization limits how well you can couple to it. But this is only because we've got this like one pole circuit, right? you know that you can do anti-reflection coatings and multipole filters. So if you could actually make it so that at all wavelengths it looked like a half a wavelength, maybe you could make it wide enough to just get all the virialized matter. So the question is, how well can you do an impedance matching? This is an impedance matching structure. It makes it so that the film can match to the impedance of the dark matter. But the trouble is, it only does it at a half wavelength, half a Compton wavelength. Can you do something that's broadband? So, but the first lesson is it'd be great if we could do a resistive sheet, and that was efficient, because it's broadband. It does all frequencies simultaneously. This is now getting much more efficient, but it's narrowband. It's a filter. So how well can we do? And we'll get to that. But let's try to actually build a model to ask the question that we're asking about how we can do an optimal search for dark matter to ask it like clearly. And so let's say that our detector is a signal source, which we're going to say is some sort of a reactive element, an inductor or capacitive element coupling to dark matter. Why do I say that? And that's because the resistive sheet didn't work. It was a terrible impedance match. But when you put a half wave back short, then you get a good impedance match. That's basically a reactive element. It's got an imaginary impedance. That's why it's narrow band. You can tune it out over a certain range. But a circuit model for that half wave resonator is an LC oscillator. So we have to assume we've got, and this is important for the fundamental limits, what we can do here. There's got to have to be some imaginary component, a reactant, an inductor or capacitor that's coupling to the dark matter. There's going to be some loss. There's going to be some quantum noise. And then you're going to have some sort of a transformer that matches you to an amplifier. And there's going to be some back action from the amplifier. And you know how to do it. And then you just use all the tools of both quantum mechanics and of double E tools to optimize this circuit. And you put in the standard quantum limit, the uncertainty that you get from measuring both quadratures, you've got a coherent amplifier. So if you build this model and try to solve it and optimize it, how well can you do? So let's be very specific. Let's just do a single pole resonator. I'm going to show you two models for what a circuit model for a detector that we're going to try to optimize. One thing is that half wave resonator, at least for a single mode of it, you can model as an LC circuit. And we're going to say for the rest of the time, we're going to just consider a single mode at a time, and different modes are you can add together and get some more sensitivity, either coherently or incoherently. But here's a simple model for like that LC type resonator, is you have some sort of an inductance that we're going to say is going to couple to the dark matter. There's going to be just some loss that there always is in a circuit. And there's going to be some capacitance, so you get some resonance. And that couples through some sort of a transformer element out to an amplifier. And this is a scattering like picture that I'm doing, where you actually picture waves that are propagating and scattering back, et cetera. You're generating some wave from dark matter. That wave is transmitted, goes through a coaxial cable, and is amplified. Yeah, you got a current wave. So you got a dark matter wave come in that's driving currents, and this is going to be now a current wave in this circuit.
In the picture,
voltage and current.
In the picture that you had before, mm-hmm. What is with the infinite conductance plate? What is L and what is C?
Yeah, so it's more that this is mathematically equivalent circuit. Yeah. Of course, when you have the two plates, it's free space. There are no electrons moving between the plates. But there is a displacement current. And mathematically, if you just write Maxwell's equations and solve it for that, and then you write Maxwell's equations for an LC oscillator, the current is like, or the magnetic field is like the current, and the electric field is like the voltage across the capacitor. And it just turns out that the math is the same. And that's why you build circuit models for things propagating in free space.
No, I was just asking something more specific. For example,
okay.
The conductance of the sheet.
That would be like the resistor. Yeah.
And the capacitance is set by what? The distance between the two sheets and the area?
No, it's not. Well, it's not that simple. It's more that you want to match, you want to choose a combination of L and C if for the free space thing that give you the right Q and the right root, the characteristic impedance.
Yeah,
and so yes, you could say that the capacitance is like, but it's more really it's a mathematical analog. And I don't know whether the C happens to map onto that capacitance. I don't think it does. because you got a wavelength, but I'm not sure. I mean, in the end, it's just you get a resonator with the right resonant frequency and the right impedance. And then all the math works. You can also describe things at the lower frequencies as, instead of being a scattering wave, and it gives you all the same answers, you can do it as a voltage amplifier or a flux amplifier, like a squid reading out an LC oscillator, which is typically what ADMX pictures itself as. But both of them will give the same sort of answer. And the question is this is a one-pole resonator, which is like an ADMX. ADMX is a free space cavity, but for each mode of ADMX, and they only use one right now, there's an equivalent LC circuit that describes it. And that's what we're mapping onto. And we have to have that L, because you have to have a reactance, because that's the only way you can decouple the photons from the dark matter. Okay, there's also a noise term. Obviously, there's going to be some thermal noise associated with the fluctuation dissipation theorem and that resistor. So you put that in, that's going to be a certain number of thermal photons in that harmonic oscillator you've got. But you also, if you have an amplifier that's measuring both the sine and cosine component, or the amplitude and the phase, these do not commute. So Heisenberg tells you that you cannot measure them both perfectly. And it turns out that behaves kind of like a noise term. It's not really noise, but it's kind of like a noise when it works out. If you measure it multiple times, you'll get different answers. And so this is just a harmonic oscillator, which we're all very familiar with. You have H bar omega times the creation operator or the number operator and plus that one half. That one half you can think of as a half photon of vacuum noise as well. It maps onto that. But you can also write that harmonic oscillator in terms of the cosine and sine quadrature, x squared and y squared. And that makes it a little bit easier to do the math, because then you have the commutator for the cosine. X is the cosine of theta and y is the sine of theta. And you know that that the commutator is basically I, and that tells you from Heisenberg's uncertainty theorem that the uncertainty in x times the uncertainty in y is going to be greater than or equal to 1/2. And that's that vacuum noise term. And you can like plot this on a phasor diagram. This is the cosine component, and this is the sine component. It's a sine wave that's 90 degrees out of phase. And then you can take any signal at a frequency and project it. It's got some phase offset. You can project it onto some cosine and sine component. But there's going to be this blob of uncertainty, that's what Heisenberg tells you, that if you do this experiment many times, even perfectly, you'll populate it in and you'll get random results within this sort of noise blob. And then if there is some signal, it'll look like an offset in that noise blob. Then thermal noise also will look like this. Thermal noise will add another photon. That's a half a photon right here. Thermal noise will add some number of photons of occupation. And also if you amplify that signal, that to give you that one in that commutator, you get a half a photon here, and if you amplify it enough to read it out with a classical circuit, you get another half a photon, and it's one photon. One photon of noise is what Heisenberg gives you. Okay, so before we can answer the question about what is the best we can possibly do, we have to have a figure of merit. And that means we have to actually think about scanning. If we knew the frequency of the axion, that we could build a resonator that went right to that frequency, and all we'd care about is the signal to noise right in the middle of that resonator. Yeah?
So what you said before, so you were just considering the noise in the amplifier, right?
Eventually you consider all noise sources, but yes. The fundamental ones are some number of photons of thermal noise in the resonator.
Yeah. From
Yeah, we're putting that in.
Yeah, and then there's the amplifier noise.
Well, there is a photon that could be a half a photon of vacuum noise from the resonator and a half from the amplifier, but you can rejigger your amplifier so it looks like all the noise in the amplifier and there's no vacuum noise. It adds up to one.
No, exactly. So okay. I guess this is what I'm getting.
Okay.
You can apply, when you talk about the fluctuation dissipation theorem,
yes.
you apply to the entire setup.
You can do a quantum fluctuation dissipation
yes,
theorem
exactly.
as well.
Yes.
Yeah, it depends on where you do the math.
Ah, okay.
But yet, even at zero temperature, you get down to that one photon. There's like many different ways to do the math, and you can do it by a quantum fluctuation dissipation relation. Yeah. What I've done here, as you see, I'll just kind of jump ahead and then come back to this. That one there is the quantum noise photon. And depending on how you do it, if you set up with a scattering mode amplifier and a circulator, you can make it so that there is no back action. We won't get it. That is quantum, and that N is thermal. That's the number of photons from a thermal distribution. Now, so as I was saying, is what we wanted to do is just to have some function that will tell us our scan sensitivity, because we don't know the frequency we're looking for. And the idea is you want to be as sensitive as you can, but at each place you're measuring, at each resonance frequency, you want to get as much bandwidth as you can so that you can take big steps in frequency. And then what you want to do is you want to write just some function that you're maximizing, which essentially maximizes your integrated signal to noise over a wide band. And if you go through that, it turns out to be a little complicated, because your signal to noise, if you have a thermal distribution, is the same even way out of the bandwidth of the resonator. You'd think normally if you'd measure within the bandwidth of the resonator, but both the thermal noise and the detected signal roll off the same. So as long as your amplifier noise is low, you can go many line widths out and have the same signal to noise. So you really want to integrate your signal to noise. And when you do that, you get something like this. And what this is this function you're trying to maximize. That is your scattering parameters. It basically has to do with how good your impedance transformer is if you go from the input signal to your amplifier as a function of frequency, is a top hat function would have, if you're a top hat transformer, would have zeros and then would be unity for a while and then would be zeros again. And an LC resonator, that S21 would look more like a Lorentzian. But the S21, that scattering parameter, that's our transformer. That appears twice. You can see here, that's your signal. Your signal has that transformer in it. Your thermal noise has that same transformer in it. And then there's a photon of quantum noise. And that's what you want to optimize, is that figure of merit. And you can plot it, and it looks like this. So then the question is now that we have this, what's best for that S21? A single pole LC resonator, why is that what people are using? Is that best? Okay, and we don't really need that one. I'll skip that one. Let's talk about what sets the limit on how well we can do that transformer. And it turns out that there is a limit. Ideally, instead of ADMX, if you weren't constrained by physics, what you'd want to do would be to say you'd make a perfect transformer that would make all frequencies perfectly impedance matched, so that you could like block the visible photons and then just measure all the dark matter and integrate for a day and be done. But there is a limit called the Bode-Fano limit. Fano, I believe, was the brother of Ugo Fano, related to him, but he was a double E professor, I think, on how good a transformer can be. If you start with a real impedance and you're transforming to a real impedance, like an amplifier, you can do that perfectly over broadband. But if you've got an imaginary term and you're dealing with passive, linear, reciprocal elements, there's a maximum of how good you can do that transformer. You can do better than an LC resonator, and it turns out that the Bode-Fano limit is this integral, the natural logarithm.
Reciprocal mean?
So a reciprocal means, if you think about it in a scattering picture, it's basically, you can turn the matrix around, that a wave going in, S21 equals S12.
Ah, okay.
If that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like when astronomers often talk about how their telescopes, they think of it in a time reverse sense of photons going back out to the sky, but they don't actually mean it. They mean in a reciprocal sense, because if there are any non-reciprocal elements, you turn the clock back in time and the light doesn't go the same direction. Yeah. Okay. But if it is those things, you've got this criterion, this complicated integral, and you want to combine that as a constraint, as an inequality on that optimization criterion that we had. I tried to do that and I couldn't, but I had turned out to have a math prodigy grad student who figured out how to do it. And it does set an exact limit on how good that U can be. And what turns out is this kind of magical, that the perfect ideal transformer is not that much better than an LC, a one-pole resonator. It's about 75% as good. And it turns out to be a top hat. You can do a multipole Chebyshev filter and do, you know, integrate 8% faster because you've got some number of squares and things, very slightly faster than an LC oscillator.
Basically, in the plot that you showed before,
yeah.
Instead of Lorentzian, you would have...
It's a top hat. That's what's ideal, but it's only a little bit better. And how you build that and then tune it to all these different frequencies is just crazy. But this basically says, okay, those ADMX guys aren't so stupid after all. They're very close to the optimal of a single pole. That's what you want to do. It's not worth it to get that 25%. Instead build a few of these things, which is probably a whole lot easier. So that's kind of nice. It means that we're kind of on the right path. But then what is that limit? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just maybe just show a couple of the different experiments and how these limits work out. Now that we understand kind of that scan criterion, we put in those quantum noise terms, we put in the thermal noise terms. The most famous experiment right now is the ADMX experiment proposed by Pierre Sakivi back in 83. We're using Primakov conversion with a magnetic field coupled to an axion, creating a photon. The idea was basically to build a resonant cavity, a microwave resonant cavity, and just ring it up with axions being converted to photons. And you scan that cavity, and you look for a signal that looks sort of like that. And they've been running for a couple of decades, haven't found axions yet, but they've done some nice exclusions of very interesting space. Up at the sort of like, and they're in the sub-gigahertz range, some number of hundreds of megahertz. Okay, another idea would be to actually, which is more interesting now, would be to kind of open it up to kind of a much larger frequency range. I guess there's still some debate, but my understanding from talking to theorists like people in this room is that the mass region for ADMX, the lower end of it, for instance, was considered a hard cutoff at one time. Now there's more theoretical models that motivate lower mass axions and higher mass. We want to do a lot larger range. But there was actually a proposal back in 2010 to replace the ADMX cavity by a lumped element oscillator, LC oscillator. It was actually at Sakivi Fest. It was by Blas Cabrera and Scott Thomas. So we have that transparency I like to show. But the basic idea is you said now you do a true lumped element, not just a lumped element model. You build a big L and a big C. Instead of like a gigahertz, you can go all the way down to 100 hertz if you want, and all the way up to 100 megahertz. So that's been proposed for some time. There's a number of experiments that are working on doing that. One of them is our experiment called the Dark Matter Radio. I already showed you kind of this cast of people that are involved in it, but we very much like our logo. You could see that there's like a little switch to go from spin zero to spin one. That's nice. That's what I added to the logo. And now you're tuning mass and frequency. Yeah. Okay, so I'll show one picture and then show the science limits. We're doing okay. Basically, this is a superconducting niobium cavity. This is the Pathfinder experiment, which is quite small that we have working now. We're moving up towards a meter cubed. These are all niobium. What's that? This is about that big. I should have had a person. Actually, I do have people buy it later. It's like about that big. So this is actually a capacitor. You see, it's a parallel plate, kind of hexagonal capacitor made out of vacuum gap and niobium with a sapphire dielectric we insert to tune. This is a niobium pickup sheath, and we wind coils around it to make a big inductor. And then if you look inside that, you put amplifiers in this sort of annex we have there. And that's just, what was that?
How tight are the wires, the winding?
Well, we don't have winding on that. That doesn't have winding. Oh, okay. The winding goes on that.
It's an amazing job in winding.
That's without winding, yes. Okay, so what is the science reach? So what you saw there was the Pathfinder. The Pathfinder does not have a magnetic field, so it's a hidden photon only. The next version, which we're now buying the Dilfridge for, will actually do axions. This is the axion plot, and this is for stage two, which is what we're putting the Dilfridge in for now, which will be about 30 liters. And stage three, which is a full meter cubed. And then red down here is a full quantum limited scan with the best you could possibly do with a one pole filter and a quantum limited measurement. Now this is the mass range. And as you can see, that especially as you get down to this meter cubed detector, the full up experiment, this is integrating for like a month per E folding. So these are pretty fast experiments, a decade and 2 months. But you can cover a very large mass range. This is 5 or 6 orders of magnitude. It's like 6 orders of magnitude in mass, large range in coupling, and getting down to QCD axion in the sort of like megahertz to 100 megahertz range. And that limit there is now, the other limits were just designed by, we're going to build this, we're going to build that. That limit is with a meter cubed for a month per E folding, That is the Heisenberg uncertainty principle limit on how well you can measure those axions for a Q that we've particularly targeted, for some sort of resistance, and assuming that we're at like 20 millikelvin. And these numbers allow us to actually set that limit. Okay. And that's our reach for hidden photons. We have some sensitivity fit for the pathfinder that you see here, but that full-up experiment, quantum limited stand, covers off enormous swaths of phase space, which is kind of nice.
What is the difference between stage 3 and quantum limit?
30 liters and a cubic meter.
Stage 3 and the quantum, what is the
rate? Oh, so the stage 3 was how we designed the experiment before we did the full analysis to understand how to optimize the detector. So this is more like if we do stage 3 correctly, then we get that line. And now that we know what correct is, turned out to be a complicated calculation. Okay, so in the remaining few minutes, what I want to say is, I'll show you some show and tell on dark matter radio at the end, is say, this is all based on the assumption that you're using an amplifier that's amplifying both quadratures, what's called a phase insensitive amplifier, just like a field effect transistor is a phase insensitive amplifier. But you can do better than that if you don't amplify both quadratures, if you don't measure both quadratures, if you just decide, well, what if I just want to look at sine for now, and I can come back and see, maybe I get unlucky and the signal's in cosine at that moment, but I come back in time and do it again, and maybe the dark matter will come into phase, then you don't have that Heisenberg limit. Heisenberg doesn't say you can measure the sine component arbitrarily well as long as it starts in the right state. So what are the techniques to measure below that standard quantum limit? Yes?
In the plots you showed, you're assuming you're building different sizes setups.
Yes.
Ah, okay.
Yes. Stage 1 and stage 2. Stage 1 is how, or stage 2, I guess, is what I called it. The 30 liters, that's how good you can do at 20 millikelvin with a Q of a million and with 30 liters.
How fast do you scan the frequency? How often do you change the frequency? For the 1 meter cubed, you have a tunable LC circuit, basically.
Yeah, they're all tunable.
Yes. So how fast do you...
And the answer is it's actually going to be stepped. It's not continuous because you have to let the vibration settle. And how large you step has to do with the fact, remember how I talked about that you've got significant out-of-band sensitivity?
Yes,
at lower frequencies, the out-of-band sensitivity is very, very large.
It has to do with
because you've got all those thermal photons in the KT is much greater than HF. When you optimize, you actually spread out your responsivity. You have the same signal noise over much larger than a part per million. It's probably more like a part per 1,000 down at the low frequencies. So in that sense, you'd be doing kind of 0.1% steps down at the low frequencies. Up at the higher frequencies, the function's not as spread out, and you'd be doing smaller fractional steps. But you do probably do a little bit of overlap. And in real scan strategies, you get some weird signal, and you're going to want to scan back and search for it.
You said the whole runtime was...
A month per decade, a month per e-folding is what we've assumed.
A month per e-folding.
Yeah. So it's like 2 months per order of magnitude, 8 orders of magnitude, 16 months. Yeah. It's not a long experiment.
The whole thing is 3 years or something.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, okay. Well, but also there's all the time where you can scan maybe an e-folding by moving your dielectric in and out, but at some point you have to warm it up and like put on a different coil set, a different number of turns, and things like that. So there's going to be all the downtime, and you have to analyze that. Okay, so. A little tight on time, so let's finish this up. Okay. So how well, how do you do better than that standard quantum limit? Sometimes people say, call the quantum limit, where you measure both quadratures, but you can beat the quantum limit, so it doesn't feel like much of a quantum limit. So a better phrase is probably the standard quantum limit, where you measure both quadratures. Okay, so this is all basic, simple harmonic oscillator stuff. But you can evade it using a whole bunch of techniques that essentially, what's common to all of them is that they take advantage of what you know about quantum correlations. And they all look like crazily different techniques, but they're all very intricately connected to each other kind of mathematically. They're all really the same thing. They can be used, different techniques can be used to give the same sort of signal noise advantage, and they look differently. So photon counting is one thing. That one's actually a little bit different. It's easy to understand. Is if you're photon counting, you're in kind of some eigenstate of a photon number, a Fock state, and then you're measuring just the number of photons. You don't know anything about phase, so you're not like messing with Heisenberg. So another approach is squeezing, where you take that circle of blob that you saw, and you use a parametric process to squeeze all the noise, so it's all in sine, and then you measure cosine. And as long as you're just measuring cosine, there's no limit on how well you can do that. Another technique, which is actually provides the same advantage, but in a different sort of regime, is called back action evasion, where you can actually set up your amplifiers so in fact you don't, so that you're not thinking of it as much in terms of amplifier noise, but in terms of the added noise of the amplifier and the back action noise from the amplifier. And then you do these tricks where you put all the back action into one quadrature and you measure the other. It's really very similar to squeezing, only it doesn't look the same. So it doesn't, one sounds more fancy. Entanglement is another thing. When you're entangling more than one variable, in fact, that's often done with a two-mode squeezer. They're very, very connected to each other. But then there's all sorts of other things you can do the same techniques you can do for this, you can do cooling. Quantum non-demolition is another thing where if you're in an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, you can measure it multiple times and get rid of like your later noise sources. But all these things are just quantum correlations. Here's the example of squeezing. Yeah, well, that describes how squeezing works. I'm not going to waste too much time on that. That's not what we're going to be using for DM radio. What we're going to be doing is actually, just because we're in a bit of an interestingly different regime. For DM radio, we're down below 100 megahertz. And if you think about the temperature, KT equals HF, when you're down like all the way to 100 hertz, these are physically unrealizable temperatures. For ADMX, is at a point where they can be in the ground state. They can always cool down in their Dilfridge to the point where HF is larger compared to than KT. You're limited by quantum noise, and you think, oh, I want to use a quantum sensor because I'm limited by quantum noise. But DM radio is in a thermal state, so why would you want to use a quantum sensor? Turns out it gives you all the same advantages. Although the math is a little bit different. And it all comes back to this function that we're trying to optimize of combination of your signal noise at every frequency and your bandwidth. And as we've said before, is we actually have the signal and noise, even though our resonator is rolling off, the signal and noise remain constant as you move out because the axion signal is rolled off and the thermal noise is rolled off. And the larger your bandwidth, the more you're scanning. So maybe we don't have better, maybe a quantum sensor couldn't improve our signal and noise on resonance, but it could give us a lot wider useful bandwidth. And the bandwidth in the end is finally limited by the amplifier noise floor.
You're dropping the red line.
We're dropping the red line. And so what we would never do is we would never do photon counting, like they're talking about doing with ADMX, because using a qubit for photon counting is just measuring the number of photons in that harmonic oscillator. We want the spectral information. Now you could actually use squeezing and squeeze the thermal state too, but back action evasion is really natural when you're in this regime, where what you want to do is you want to couple to your amplifier really, really strongly, which drops your noise floor. Your noise referred back. If you want to increase the gain of your amplifier, increase how strongly you couple to your amplifier, then your amplifier noise referred back to the input gets smaller and smaller. But you can't do that forever, because then you get back action from your amplifier on your system, and that gives you noise. But back action evasion means the back action goes into sine, you measure cosine, and that allows you to drop that line well below what you would have for the standard quantum limit.
Compared to the squid, what would that mean?
Okay, so
refer to very specific.
You can't do that. I'm going to show you.
Okay.
You can't do this with a DC squid, which actually measures both quadratures. So. And this is the last kind of new thing I'll show you, is that there's actually a different kind of squid-like amplifier that we've developed that we're using actually in all the next generation of cosmic microwave background experiments. We're using in X-ray systems. And it's basically, it's much like a DC squid, but it's actually a frequency up converter. And what it is it's a reactive amplifier where you're using a Josephson junction like a variable inductor. that the Josephson relations, you have that, you know, I equals IC sine phi, and you have a voltage that goes as d phi dt, and those that kind of map for a small signal, they look like an inductor, V equals L di dt. And so if you couple a Josephson junction in a loop, and I've drawn one particular thing, there's a number of different versions. If you have a loop that has junctions in it, and you couple a flux from your resonator that you're measuring into it, that will change the inductance of that loop. And that will cause another resonator at a high frequency to have its frequency shift. So what we do is we build a resonator that's about 6 gigahertz, which is coupled to a microwave output line. And then we have a Josephson junction in a loop that couple to our driven circuit. And what that does is it changes the frequency of the resonator. And the way we operate it is actually ends up changing the phase of a transmitted signal in the resonator. So what it's doing is it's an up converter. It's taking a photon in your simple harmonic oscillator at a kilohertz and putting it in this resonator at 6 gigahertz and making it like a 6 gigahertz plus 1 kilohertz photon. It's up converting that photon. You get gain, not so much in photon number, but in terms of the energy of that photon. And this can be a quantum limited device, but it also allows you to start doing all sorts of interesting quantum mechanical protocols. And rather than trying to describe the device design, which I don't have any time for, what I can do is I can invoke an analogy to justify this. That it turns out that you can write a Hamiltonian for this system, which is the exact same Hamiltonian that people that are doing mechanical resonators driven by superconducting microwave circuits, like the cooling nanomechanical resonators to the ground state, use, where you have a low frequency DM radio resonator, which is at like at a kilohertz to 100 megahertz, and then you have a high frequency resonator. So you've got, and then if you don't couple them, you just have, you know, an H bar omega squid, which is what I'm calling here, the squid one here, with a number operator, H bar omega resonator. So this is uncoupled. Then you write the Hamiltonian for the coupled system, and you actually have to mess around with your symmetries of your junctions and your flux bias, but you can actually get a Hamiltonian that then couples them, adds this coupled term, which is basically A dagger A, B plus B dagger. And it turns out that this is the exact same Hamiltonian as in these nanomechanical resonators.
And there's no buck action?
Well, there is, but you can do all sorts of tricks, which you can borrow from the nanomechanical resonator community. So let me just show the parallel, and the next slide I'll show what they do with these. And there's actually some stuff that they're looking at doing with LIGO as well, but in the nanomechanical community, where you start instead, you actually start pumping it with a blue line and a red line just to the two sides of the resonance. And by messing with the phases and those drive pumps, you can start doing all sorts of interesting things like cooling. You can align it so that all your back action goes into just one quadrature. All those things are possible. What I'll do here is I'm just going to point you to this paper, because this is like another hour. This paper for how, it's a Keith Schwab paper, for how Nature Physics, how they do back acting evasion measurements of nanomechanical motion. And this is a device where they've got a gigahertz resonator, electromagnetic resonator, and a nanomechanical device. But it's the same Hamiltonian, only we've replaced the nanomechanical device with DM radio oscillator. And these are coupled, and you can do all these tricks where you have a resonator and you have a blue pump, on a hot pump, and a red pump. And by messing around with them, you can do all the, you can squeeze, you can put all the back action into one quadrature. All these things are possible. And they've done all the hard work for us.
And that also suppresses the thermal noise coming from the...
Well, that they have, you can also do cooling, but what they've done is they've actually have the nanomechanical resonators that are isolated enough, and they're not at a kilohertz, where they can actually use their kind of their two pumps to do sideband cooling as well. All these things are possible. I don't think we can sideband cool DM radio because I think the coupling to the phonons is too strong. But we can do back action evasion the same way. And here's how it all maps is like, you know, their displacement of their resonator is our flux. Their momentum is our charge. Spring constant to inductance, mass goes to capacitance. Then it's all the same Hamiltonian. So I'll just invoke that, which is a totally new talk, is that all these things are possible. That allows you to drop that line and open up your science reach.
There you're dropping the bottom of the range?
I'm buffing the, that red line. We're dropping the red line.
Yes, sorry, I mean on your reach plot.
Yeah.
This is
my V. Oh, yes, okay, well that's the conclusion right there. Okay, and I'm actually, so I have a plot, the science plot. Okay, so I can go back to this. Let me just say that with the concluding slide here, this is just show and tell, so we can do it or not. But yes, that basically allows you to start scanning below that line. How far you can go, how many dBs below is unclear. You can probably, squeezing people can do to maybe 20 or 30 dBs. Back action evasion may be a little bit more robust against noise and dissipation, may be able to do better, but it's still early days with this. It all needs to be demonstrated. Anyway, that's how you do all this. Let me just flip through some show and tell slides and we'll end there. Here is DM radio. I was going to describe, the geometries to couple to axions and hidden photons. Why don't we just go to pictures of the device instead? That'd be more fun. Here we go. So here's the Pathfinder. This one was basically done on a shoestring budget. We now have some Heising-Simons support to build the first real phase. But basically, just because we want to do this on the cheap, we made this small device and we're putting it in liquid helium. So it's pretty hot, but you can dunk it, you can do it quick, you can do it easy. And what it is it's a superconducting shield to keep out all the electromagnetic interference. And then the only hidden photons, because we don't have a magnet yet, go in. You've got kinetic mixing, and you've got an LC oscillator in there that they ring up. You've got a superconducting amplifier, and then the signals go up to room temperature. So there, you actually saw that already. There's the parallel plate capacitor. Then we have sapphire dielectrics that we put in. We can only use these materials that have very low loss. We're only using niobium and sapphire. An insulator and a superconductor, which is mechanically complicated just because both of these things have very low loss and we want Q of a million. So you saw that picture. There is the Dewar that we borrowed from another experiment full of liquid helium. Here is the outer superconducting shield and inside is that pickup sheath and that oscillator that gets lowered in. There's everyone standing by it smiling. And there is, we're now running it. We're running it at low Q, meaning right now we're using aluminum wire bonds, which are normal. We actually thought it'd be easier to find the resonances too, which started with low Q. So here is kind of the range of the DM radio pathfinder. Here is a resonance at 500 kilohertz, and here's a resonance at 6 megahertz. Both of them fit pretty well. We need to understand a little bit of stuff that's going on in that tail. But this is just the thermal ring up at 4 Kelvin. The thermal photons in that resonator, it's what we would expect. The Q.
Say 8.
8, 6, because I mistyped. 8 megahertz. Good eye. I made that really small so no one would see that. Yes, no. No, it is 500 kilohertz to 8 megahertz. I'll fix that. 8.4 megahertz.
And Q is roughly 1,000.
So the Q of this one, because what is fixed in both of these experiments is the inductance is the same and the resistance is the same. So the bandwidth is a little bit closer. It's higher Q up at higher frequency. The Q is, I think, 5,000 or 6,000 up here. I didn't write that down, did I? And it's like 2,500 down here. 2,800 up there, right? So a little bit higher Q at higher frequency. But it's all roughly consistent with the loss from the normal wire bonds. Niobium wire bonds are tricky, but we think we have them working and that's what we'll do next. And crank the Q up, hopefully up to like a million. Yeah. So it's basically working. And the conclusion is that at this point, I think we can say we understand kind of the optimization. There is an absolute limit of how well we can do, but then you can punch holes in it and fall through with these quantum protocols. But we understand kind of how to optimize our scan. We understand that an LC oscillator is really what you want to do. Just a one pole is close enough to ideal. And before that, it wasn't clear. We're excited to not only get this whole thing working and keep it working up to larger fields and lower temperatures and larger volumes, but also make these really fun frequency up converters, which we're using for other things as well, and get all these quantum protocols working. We're kind of in engineering runs now, But we'll start doing science scanning on the Pathfinder while we're installing the dilution refrigerator for the next stage. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
First of all, questions from students. There's going to be a quiz on Kirchhoff's rules afterwards. Do we have any questions in general?
So it's interesting to see that all these quantum limited management techniques discussed in gravitational wave detection community can be used here.
Yes, and you're right that I was actually describing it as the same Hamiltonian as the nanomechanical resonator, because that's the community that I'm in. It's the same technology, but it's the same Hamiltonian that LIGO is using.
Right.
So yeah, it's pretty neat, yeah.
So my question is, I'm being crazy right now, but if you have a cavity that resonates at all frequencies, okay, like or a given frequency band, do you think that will help your detection? Because now you have a single pole.
Yeah, yeah. And the answer is that's what this optimization function is asking. Well, I should caveat and say, when you have multiple modes, I haven't dealt with that here. Having multiple modes that you read out can actually increase your science reach over this. But the, a lot of slides here. Go back to, I went past it. Where's my... Almost there. There. Okay. So the question that you're asking is how wide band do you want to make that cavity? What will give you the best total science reach? And it's actually a complicated question because you can either be narrow band and be more sensitive, but then have to scan with more steps, or you can be wide band and be less sensitive, integrate longer for each one, but have fewer steps. And how do you optimize that? Is that your question?
Yeah, so the reason I asked this question, so we have similar problems in gravitational wave detection. So we can make a resonator which is narrow band, then we have very high sensitivity within the narrow band.
Yes.
But then people discuss, instead of like making multiple modes in resonator, they have some optical mechanical device which can just somehow broaden your bandwidth without sacrificing the sensitivity. So you just put some negative dispersion, so you can reach some effective negative dispersion with this kind of auto-mechanic device.
Okay. And I'll say, so first of all, there's one thing that may be different from LIGO, which I'll caveat, and then I'll answer the other thing. The one thing that may be different is there is, if you just think of a resonator as ringing up so you get more total energy, like suppose if you think of a resonator that has a constant power going in, and if Q is 10 times higher, you have 10 times more energy. This is not just that. By going to higher Q, we also improve our impedance match to the dark matter. We get more power because we actually do a better decoupling from the optical photons. So that may be different from the LIGO situation. But then the other question is can you do some magic to broaden the bandwidth? And with an important caveat, we answer that question with this Bode-Fano thing. And that important caveat is that we're assumed, this is proven for the case where your transformer is linear, passive, and reciprocal. If you're only going to design a cavity with linear, passive components, then in fact, you can't do it arbitrarily well because we're starting with an imaginary term. We can't transform that to a real impedance over broad bandwidth. There's a fundamental limit on how well we can do it. And you can optimize that. And you optimize that according to our particular figure of merit, which is this U, which optimizes the integral signal to noise over bandwidth. So LIGO, presumably, because they're generally like a decade ahead of us on everything, at least, has presumably figured out how to, what the optimization function is and what their constraints are and has optimized that. Or maybe it's using nonlinear components or something like that,
yeah,
which is a totally different regime.
Yeah, the same optomechanical field that I was mentioning is not passive, so it's not.
Yes,
passive, yeah.
And then the answer is we just haven't probed that at all. If doing nonlinear things is feasible, then we have not placed a constraint on that.
So another question I have is, I don't know, so whether this device will be applicable for according to OMD that you have higher frequency to use, whether this would be useful.
Well, I mean,
So
in this particular device, you want to have some sort of resonator or transducer that's coupling to it. There's the atom interferometers. There's gravitational waves. This is not transducing length. It's not designed to transduce length. And in fact, all the capacitors are like centered so that they're like at a peak, so that they're not very sensitive to length reduction. There's no interferometry involved in this, except maybe in the amplifiers. So I don't think this is the particular tool set one would use for gravitational wave detection. But all these quantum mechanical techniques and some of the amplifiers, like there's the old gravitational wave aluminum bars, which I think Mina was telling me people are still doing that now. But like back in the 90s, aluminum bars coupled to squid amplifiers were kind of one of the leading gravitational wave detectors. And that is more similar to this device, but then it's a mechanical mode that you're coupling to.
Mm-hmm. Can you say a bit about what's limiting the frequency range?
Yeah, so the 100 hertz we've chosen, just because I don't believe we can build a resonator that works well at low frequency, lower frequency than that, with just L's and C's. Because you start getting parasitic capacitance, which leaves you all sorts of crazy resonances below that. You could probe down lower than that with this sort of approach if you then couple to a different resonator, like a mechanical resonator. But right now, that 100 hertz is just as low as we're going to get with big old L's and C's, especially with L's wound by grad students. At the high frequency range, well, there's two reasons why we stopped at 100 megahertz-ish. One is we go up too much higher, we're doing ADMX, and there's already people doing ADMX.
I noticed there was a hole, so be interesting.
There's a little bit of a hole, but the reason why I have cited 100 megahertz is the particular amplifiers that we're using are using lithographic superconducting coils to transduce currents into magnetic fields that couple to our amplifiers. And because they're lithographic coils, there's some parasitic capacitance between the coil and the ground plane. And so your coil has some L, your parasitic capacitance has some C, so there's going to be some frequency where the impedances become equal, 1 over square root LC. What happens above that frequency is your current, instead of going through the inductor and getting into your amplifier, shorts through your parasitic capacitance. So you can go higher, but you have to start using tricks, like what John Clark did with the resonant squids for ADMX. And then it's just a different amplifier design.
Okay.
Okay.
Yet again.
Thank you.